The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today, Sherrod Brown. Hello, Sherrod.
How are you? Good to be back with you.
This is great. This is the publication date today of a book you put out last year in hardcover. It's called Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. And as we are recording this, it just came out in paperback with a new afterword, which you've written. And apparently you wrote it rather recently because it's pretty darn current.
Well, I wrote it. Yeah, the book came out last November when we did this interview the first time, Vic. Then the publisher said, the paperback usually comes out about a year later, and he said, why don't you write something and update it? And I didn't know at the time that we'd go through impeachment, and then which seemed really big at the time, but now is sort of almost lost to history. And then obviously this pandemic, so I kept writing right up until the deadline and changing because the pandemic was so difficult to describe, and you know the impact was so huge on our country and on the world and on so many people's lives, all of our lives, really. So I did, that's just a 3,500 word chapter at the end of the book that gives it some context for today.
Senator, I'm sure we have some listeners out there who missed our first conversation. So let's tell them how you got the idea to write about Desk 88. What is Desk 88 and where did you get this idea?
Yeah, I've worked on this book for 10 years because I have this day job in the U.S. Senate and lots to do. So I was in no hurry to write it, but I just, early in my time in the Senate, right at the beginning, everything's done by seniority. You choose which desk you're going to sit at, which office you're going to have, what committees you're on, and you're sort of at the 100 members. You're in the last 10, as there were 10 freshmen that year. So as we were looking around the Senate to decide where to sit, each of us, someone told me that senators carved their names in the bottom of the desk drawer. So I pulled out, as I was looking at the only desks that were left of the 10, I started pulling out a desk drawer and looking, and I saw one desk. It said Al Gore, Senior, Tennessee, Hugo Black, Alabama, George McGovern, South Dakota. Then it just said Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy sat about five desks away. I said, Ted, come here a second, would you? And he walked over. I said, which brother's desk was this? And he said, well, it's got to be Bobby's desk because I have Jack's. So I thought, I want this desk. So I started thinking about the senators who had held this desk that had scratched their name in it. Many I hadn't heard of, many I had. And I just started reading. My wife got me a bunch of books early in my Senate time because I think if you read history of something you're doing, you do the job better. And I think I'm better serving Ohio because I've read literally, as you can see in the bibliography, I read 150 books or so. I did the research. Nobody wrote this for me, anything like that. That's why it took 10 years. But I read these books about the Senate, and especially progressives that moved this country. And I realized the theme they had through all of them, all these senators, were they believed government could be a positive force in our lives. Many of them fought for Medicare, fought for Social Security, fought for collective bargaining rights, fought for a better environment, fought for helping low-income people. Most of them didn't use the term dignity of work, but they all understood the dignity of work, that in America, if you work hard, you ought to be able to have a decent standard of living. And you know, we don't have that today, and that's what I fight for.
When I was a small boy, I had three heroes. Number one was my dad. Number two was the astronaut John Glenn, who had just orbited the Earth with Project Mercury. And number three was our president at the time, John F. Kennedy. And I'll never forget reading his book, Profiles in Courage. And as I was reading Desk 88, I pictured a young Sherrod Brown doing the same thing.
Well, thanks. I don't know quite how to respond to that, except I do have a picture of John Glenn in my office sitting right above me. And John Glenn was, I got to know John. John spoke at my Eagle Scout dinner, and I got a picture with John Glenn. I never met President Kennedy, of course, or your dad either, for that matter. But it was, it, it, the book, I didn't really think about it as Profiles in Courage. I somebody else said that to me, in one review, somebody mentioned that. But I can see some similarities. U.S. Senator writing about people that showed courage, and in some of the one of the things I noticed about these eight senators, some of them were courageous from the beginning. Some of them got more courage as they got older. Al Gore Sr., Hugo Black, they were not great at the beginning, and they grew into that. And by the end, they were gutsy. They were smart. Gore lost his seat because he stood up on issues of race. And he stood up to LBJ of his own party in the Vietnam War. Then he stood up to Nixon as Nixon played to race and tried to scare people about civil rights and voting rights and fair housing. And that cost Gore his seat, likely. And he knew it might. I think he probably knew it probably would, but he was still willing to do it. And that's the mark of obviously what elected officials should be.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Senator Sherrod Brown and his book Desk 88. Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America just came out in paperback with a new afterword written by Sherrod. And you just mentioned LBJ. You've got some great photos in here. And one of my favorites is the one where Theodore Francis Green is getting it from LBJ.
Yeah. Yeah, Green, no, few listeners will know who T.F. Green is. If you ever fly into the Providence Airport, and we have two grandchildren in Cranston, which is 6 miles from that airport, something like that. So we haven't flown there, obviously, in months now, but used to anyway. But the airport's named after T.F. Green. He was a diminutive. I mean, he was probably about 5'1". I don't quite pinpoint that, but he was very short. LBJ was, I think, 6'3". Uh-huh. And LBJ could be pretty tough and not always nice. And Green sort of turned on LBJ on a couple of things. And LBJ was the picture of him. It's one of the most famous pictures in the Senate. LBJ was just barking at Green, and Green kept backing up. LBJ kept kind of pushing, and it was didn't touch him. But LBJ. I mean, one of the things I think about this election today is Joe Biden can be LBJ. I mean, Joe Biden. What's happened with progressives in this country is that the progressive movement doesn't ascend and govern all that often, but when it does really big, long-lasting things. With FDR, we got Social Security, labor law, minimum wage, 8-hour workday, rural electrification changing millions of lives. With FDR, with LBJ, we got voting rights, civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, Higher Ed Act, primary and secondary act, the Wilderness Act, helping with state and national parks, all those things. And then, and they don't usually last very long, but the president leads in a really consequential way. And I think that the three great moral issues of our times right now, climate change, and the president's still denying that there's climate change. And I think, you know, there's nobody under 40 I've ever met that agrees with that. And a whole lot of most people over 40 think there's climate change, too. And it's partly human caused. The three moral issues of climate change, racial disparities and wealth inequality. And I think Biden, as the new president, I expect him to win. I think it's close, and I expect him to win Ohio. But I think that we're going to see Biden be a pretty consequential, important president, maybe comparable to the accomplishments of LBJ.
You mention in the book that a third of our senior citizens in Ohio depend upon Social Security for most of their income. And Social Security really seems to be under threat right now. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I think that Social Security is under threat now. Trump has this idea to if done too long, would deplete the Social Security Trust Fund. I mean, one of the things that LBJ, that FDR did, and I do a chapter in the book about the beginning of Social Security and how nobody really knew what it, the voters, the beneficiaries, workers, didn't really know what it was. They got it, you know, it passed by Congress. They knew something happened, but people don't pay attention to that much detail. And so a worker guy, the grandfather of a woman that worked in my office, she had this letter, and her grandfather got this letter. He was a utility worker in Pennsylvania, and he got a letter saying that we're going to start taking money out of your check, and then we'll pay you that and more with a pension. when you retire at 65. And he got this letter in 1938, and he didn't, you know, most people didn't live to be 65, so they probably weren't really excited about this, but the purpose of the chapter was to show that government made this promise on Social Security, and government's always lived up to it, never been late with one Social Security check ever. But it is under threat now, and it's under threat so often from conservative politicians that say we ought to privatize Social Security. People can make more money instead of less. Well, if you privatize something, you privatize Medicare, profiteers make money, the business interests make money, but in the end, the public loses. And so that fight happens every half a generation or so. Some politicians, I mean, Ronald Reagan tried to do it. George Bush II tried to do it, tried to partially privatize Medicare or Social Security or both. And we always beat it back because the public's overwhelmingly supportive of Medicare and Social Security. So I thought it was really important to show how these eight progressive senators, all of them supported Social Security. Some had to really fight for it against business interests that were trying to privatize. The fight goes on. Like all of these progressive victories, progressives will win Medicare, Social Security, collective bargaining, Higher Ed Act, Primary Secondary Act, all these things, the Wilderness Act. But they're always progressive. They're always conservative forces pushing back, trying to undo this progress.
Another bedrock institution that seems to be really under threat, and this one worries me so much because it's so important to so many people, is the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, I didn't talk a lot about the Postal Service because there wasn't this sort of political takeover that we've seen now with the Trump administration, where he put one of his biggest contributors, who contributed and raised a lot of money for Trump, and this guy, we've never seen the post office has never been politicized. I mean, people have been unhappy with time to time. We've reformed it. We've made changes. But, you know, the Postal Service is a very important part of our country. It employs thousands of union workers. I mean, tens of hundreds of thousands of union workers at good paying jobs. You can count on it. I had a woman on, we did a radio call not too long ago. I talked with a woman from Dayton, and she has she's, I believe, in her mid-40s. She's been on disability for 15 years. She has gotten her medication from the VA in the mail like clockwork for 15 years, and now it's been delayed because of the political games going on with the VA, with the Postal Service. It's not the VA, it's the Postal Service, and she's always been able to rely. And it's important to small business. It's important, obviously, to voting this year, and it's important to so many people getting their VA benefits. And a huge percentage, something like 80% of Ohioans who get VA assistance get it through the Postal Service, and we absolutely shouldn't be messing with it the way the president wants to. And the Postal Service can handle the volume of mail for voting. I have no doubt about that. A postal worker, I was talking to a group of postal workers that told me that the Postal Service handles 400 million pieces of mail every day. In a country of 300 million people, that's not surprising. 400 million pieces of mail a day. Yet in the voting, that most there'll be 150 million people voting over the course of 6 weeks through the Postal Service by mail. So they can handle this. It's just the people in charge now. The guy in charge is way too political and has done damage to the Postal Service that we will fix once Trump leaves office. But it's troubling.
Well, Senator, with this pandemic going on, so many more people are going to be voting by mail. And I'm sure you received the mailing from our Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, of the absentee ballot request. And the date on it was return this by October 27th to then receive your ballot in the mail, which you then need to return by Election Day. And doing the math, I don't see how that's possible if you mailed it on October 27th. I think we're going to have a lot of mail-in ballots that might not get counted if people wait that long.
Yeah, people, I don't know if that's – I think the Postal Service is pretty good at turning things around. But the Board of Elections, I mean, it's risky. So I suggest to anybody – my wife and I already sent our absentee ballot request in. The Board of Elections in Ohio, every state's a little different. And that's why the post office screwed this up, and why how he's politicized it, that shouldn't have even gone out like that. But anyway, in Ohio, can send in your application anytime, and the Board of Elections will mail out the ballots on October 6th or 7th, right as soon as it's legal for them to do it. So you should get your ballot if you mail in anytime in the next week or so. You should get your ballot by October 7th or 8th or 9th. If you don't, you should call the Board of Elections. So I just urge everybody to vote early. Either vote by mail, or you can vote at the Board of Elections in Xenia or Dayton or Cincinnati or Batavia, depending on where you are, at the local Board of Elections. You can vote anytime in person after October 6th until Election Day. So either go in person, it should be less crowded than the polls and safer, or vote by mail, but do it as early as you possibly can to make sure you're satisfied that your ballot will get processed and counted.
You also suggest that we find five people. What do you mean?
Well, I think that there are, you know, people listen to this show. If they're still with us, they just listen to your show because it's such a good public affairs show. They care about this stuff. They pay a lot of attention. I don't worry about them voting. I don't worry about their interest in this election. But there are a lot of people, you know, a lot of voters don't think much about it, may not get around to it, or they may have forgotten to register, or they may not know how to do it because it's their first vote or whatever. I just encourage everybody listening to go out, find five people, and educate them, show them how to register, show them how to, once they get their ballot in the mail, sit down, talk to them about the candidates. Just make it, and make a plan to vote. I mean, more and more people are saying, go make a plan to vote. Decide how you're going to do it. Sit down now with your spouse or your kids or your friends and say, okay, do we want to vote absentee? If we do, let's fill this out. Maybe with the pandemic, it's obviously different, but maybe we decide, you know, we decide how we're going to do this, and do we want to go early vote? And ask yourself those questions and make a plan about how you're going to vote and stick to it.
My guest is Sherrod Brown. His book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. We better talk about a couple more of these senators. You mentioned Bobby Kennedy, and I often wonder what might have been. And this is a guy who really went through a transformation late in his life, didn't he?
Yeah, late in his very brief life. He died at 42, my recollection, I think 42, yeah. He had a bit of a checkered past. He worked for Joe McCarthy. He was not the nicest man when he ran his brother's campaign for president. I mean, maybe campaign managers can never be that nice. Mm. And he, in a race of that kind of pressure. And then he was a guy that he craved, he did. Well, my favorite Lincoln quote is Lincoln used to say, I got to go get my public opinion bath and get out and talk to people. Mm. Kennedy did that better than probably anybody in the Senate. And it's unusual for politicians, frankly, to do enough of that, to go out and listen to people's pain and suffering. And I would contend today Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, has not done that at all, or he wouldn't be acting the way he has if he really had any real idea by personal conversations with the immense suffering out there, with people losing their unemployment benefit of $600 a week, with people worried about school opening without making the schools safe enough because there's no federal money to help the schools already overburdened with lower tax revenues and all the responsibilities of keeping the schools safe. Kennedy spent much of his last 3 or 4 years going out, after his brother died, really, going out and seeing the pain and suffering, and it just changed him. And he came back and could explain those things to the public, and he was a very different person. And I mean, the Kennedys all sort of grew after. John Kennedy was never considered that good a senator. Ted Kennedy's first 20 years in the Senate weren't all that productive. His last 20 made him, I would suggest, maybe the best senator in U.S. history. Bobby Kennedy, up until his brother's assassination, really wasn't the public official he became in the next 3.5 years.
At the beginning of Trump's administration, Leader McConnell was able to hammer through the big tax cut, and now we've got this really dire need for more stimulus spending, and suddenly some of these senators on the other side of the aisle have turned into fiscal hawks. What's going on with the stimulus? Where is that right now?
Well, unfortunately, it's not anywhere. We have the House passed. We passed unanimously back in end of March, the CARES Act, which really has made an impact because of the $600 a week for this for the almost a million Ohioans who are unemployed. There weren't many people at all around the country that slipped into poverty because people could continue to pay their bills with that $600 a week, and that expired in August. And Trump and McConnell seemed to think that was okay that it expired. The House passed a bill to renew it and to put money into schools and local governments to help keep people afloat, to help small businesses. And Congress is simply the House passed the bill in May, as I said, and the McConnell has just refused to take it up and then offered a sort of a pathetic substitute for this, not even close to meeting the needs of the hundreds of thousands of Ohio workers who are unemployed and others.
We need leadership so badly right now, and we've got this cavalier disregard for COVID-19, this indoor rally in Nevada. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's so troubling that the president thinks it's so. I mean, the president's response was, well, I was on the stage far away. Well, we really weren't talking about your safety. We're talking about the safety of the hundreds of people in the audience that, you know, that they – and what you see on TV is you see them standing there. What you don't see is many of them have been there for 2 or 3 hours already. No masks, no distancing, and against the rules that the governor laid out. I mean, I look at Mike DeWine, and DeWine and I, we ran against each other for the Senate in 2006. So we've not always been allies by a long shot. But, you know, he did what Ohio needed in March and April and May when Trump was doing the opposite. And Biden and DeWine saved lives by what he did in those months. And Trump has cost lives when he continues to ignore how serious this is and how severe this is. And by putting people, I mean, you're not going to see Democratic rallies like that, not because people don't want to come out and support Biden, because I think he's going to win, but because they don't want to be stupid about it. And the way and what Trump has done to get people to go to these rallies is just pretty awful, I think.
And we won't even talk about Amy Acton. My guest is Jared Brown. And you wrote in your new afterword to Desk 88, which just came out today in paperback, you wrote something I never expected to write. You say the president of the United States is a racist and that he has been willing to use race as a political weapon to stimulate his political base and to divide our country. Whoa. What a statement.
It speaks for itself. I mean, look at he's trying to win this election by turning, you know, suburb against city, by turning black against white, by turning peaceful protesters into violent protesters, by turning white supremacists against the rest of us. And unfortunately, I think he thinks it works. I think it's the only thing. I mean, I think in Trump's mind, you know, remember a few weeks ago, Vic, he said that he wants to move the election back. I think he does because he realized in his mind there's a good chance he's going to lose. And so he's doing desperate things already. And any other president that would have had what happened to Mr. Floyd and then the protests afterwards, overwhelmingly peaceful, and then a few weren't, the president would have tried to heal and bring people together. And instead, he's just throwing gasoline on it, on the fire. And it's tragic because, I mean, Nixon, as divisive as he was, didn't even do that the same way. And it's not going to work politically for Trump, but he thinks it's his only chance.
Our nation is literally on fire.
Yeah, and you look at what's happened in the West, and the president goes out and says forest management. Well, one thing, if it's forest management, he's in charge of the management, but it's clearly there's something probably to the way we manage forests, and we don't probably invest enough to keep them as resistant to fire as possible. But there are the fact that he has been denying climate change. I mean, he's an anti-science guy, and he doesn't believe in the science of medicine. He should have turned over right from this. I mean, imagine if President Trump in March, around the time of the interviews with Woodward, if he had decided, okay, this is really serious. He told the country, he talked to us like adults. He started wearing a mask himself. He instructed everybody around him to and said how important it was. He practiced social distancing and told us to. And equally importantly, he said that the Centers for Disease Control will be in charge of our response, because the Centers for Disease Control, and I talked a lot about this in the Hugo Black chapter, I think. I think it was that in the Proxmire chapter, the Centers for Disease Control helped to lead the world in eradication of smallpox, which killed hundreds of millions of people 100-plus years ago. It led in the eradication of the almost entire eradication of polio. It was very involved in the Ebola virus, combating the Ebola virus, where only two people in the United States died from Ebola virus. I mean, it really led the way, and the president has put a bunch of political people. There have never been political people at the CDC, put a bunch of political people at the CDC, and the CDC has lost its credibility and should be leading in this and instead isn't. And part of the CDC, as you know, Vic, in the city of Cincinnati, is the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. And I have been there a number of times. They are some of the most impressive professionals I've ever seen. Their job is to keep people safe in the workplace. They're part of the CDC, and they've just not gotten the support from the president that they ought to have. They have saved lives. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health in Cincinnati has saved lives because they've made workplaces safer. That's the job of the government, and we see during this pandemic there's a really important role for government, and that's really what I wrote in Desk 88 time after time after time, the importance of the role of government in Medicare, Social Security, the environment, collective bargaining, auto safety, all the things that government's done to make people's lives better.
And your final senator in the book is someone you got to know and someone who I admired so greatly, George McGovern. What a guy.
Yeah, he's the only one of the eight senators I met. I think I saw Proxmire once from a distance, but I didn't know anybody. But McGovern I got to know fairly well after I came to the Senate. And he devoted his life to combat hunger. He was elected in a state where it looked impossible. Three times he got elected in South Dakota. He finally lost. He tells a story that Walter Mondale, after losing overwhelmingly in an election, winning one state, went up to McGovern 8 years after McGovern had lost, 12 years after McGovern had lost, and he said, how long does it take to get over losing like that in a presidential race in front of the whole country? And McGovern said, I'll let you know, Walt Fritz, when I'm over it. And it's, but he went on with his life, and he had tragedy in his life. His daughter was mentally ill and ended up dying tragically in Madison, Wisconsin. And McGovern was a little bit like Biden. I mean, Biden's had immense tragedy in his life. His daughter, his wife, and later a son who were killed in a car accident when Biden was was senator-elect, is right after the election. Then his son, an adult, died of cancer. Served in the military, died of cancer in his 30s. And I think there's a theme and part another theme running through this book, those elected officials that have suffered some personal tragedy, whether it's, these senators, and I think especially of McGovern and the tragedy he suffered. It just made them, and I think of Biden now, it makes them, more compassionate, more empathetic human beings, and that really matters.
Senator, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Good. Well, we'll do it again sometime, Vic.
Thank you.
Probably not another book, because I don't know if that's ever coming, but I appreciate this call and this interview, and it was as much fun as the last time, so thank you.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Sherrod Brown. His new book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America, just out in paperback. You heard about it on the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.